From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, life under perhaps the most extreme Islamic rule in the world. In Afghanistan, a religious movement known as the Taliban has barred women from going to work or school, required men to pray five times a day, banned kite flying and secular music, and reinstituted public executions for adultery. We talk with New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief John Burns, who has been covering the story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A meeting set for tonight in Israel could put the finishing touches on a plan to withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank town of Hebron. The U.S. diplomat says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat will meet. They may conclude the tense negotiations. The Associated Press quotes a senior Israeli official who says the meeting could end with agreement, but not necessarily the signing of a pact. There reportedly are a few more details yet to be worked out. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak doubts reports that a series of letter bombs recently sent to Washington, D.C., Leavenworth, Kansas, and the United Nations came from Egypt. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Mubarak said Egyptian authorities were waiting to receive some of the original envelopes for 17 letter bombs American authorities said were sent from Alexandria. The Egyptian leader told reporters that it was easy to imitate stamps and postmarks and send them from anywhere. Senior Egyptian security officials have been quoted in local newspapers as saying it was impossible for the letter bombs to be sent to the offices of the Al Hayat newspaper in London and Washington to have come from Alexandria. Meanwhile, police were posted outside the downtown Cairo headquarters of Al Hayat, and staff members there were warned not to open letters from unknown sources. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the letter bombs, but the FBI has speculated that they may be linked to a band of Muslim extremists who were imprisoned for their role in the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
President Clinton will name three-term Colorado Governor Roy Romer as head of the Democratic National Committee. He would be assisted in day-to-day operations by Steve Grossman, a former state party chairman and president of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Administration officials say Romer came to Washington to accept the president's offer and will be named later this week. He'll replace Senator Christopher Dodd, who said he would serve only through the 1996 election. Romer and Clinton have been close allies for years, working together on national organizations as governors. Romer will remain as Colorado's governor but serve as the party's main spokesman. Grossman will assume the role of chairman and take on day-to-day management responsibilities. The choice of Romer is considered shrewd because of his roots in state government, his loyalty to Clinton, and his ability to communicate effectively through the media. He'll serve as the party undergoes scrutiny for its fundraising practices. Grossman is also considered a wise pick because of his political roots and his private sector management skills. The team will be formally approved by the DNC later this month. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up well over 38 points at 6,748. Trading is heavy on volume of 229 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up more than 11 points at 1,342. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the government says consumer prices climbed 3.3% during 1996. That's the biggest gain in 6 years. The Labor Department says the increases were led by jumps in energy and food costs. Economist Nancy Kimmelman says this indicates that inflation could still be a factor.
There is still concern that although wage pressures are not being seen at the consumer price level, and they aren't even necessarily being seen at the wholesale price level, the price pressures are building, especially in the labor market. So although the CPI is very good news for us in terms of there being very little inflation in the economy, it's not apparent that we're out of the woods yet with inflation.
The government released a second economic report today. Retail sales in December rose 0.6%. An AT&T communications satellite that Loral Space and Communications has agreed to buy has been out of operation since Saturday. Operators aren't sure if they'll regain contact. The Telstar 401 satellite beams signals for several large networks. None was forced off the air, and most customer signals have been rerouted. But the incident could be significant for Loral, which was supposed to complete purchase of the satellite by the end of March. Loral expects to go ahead with the acquisition. The satellite was insured, and the money could be used to launch a new, more powerful satellite. Harsh wintry weather continues to cause problems throughout the country. More than 90 inches of snow were reported in parts of upstate New York in less than 48 hours. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 48 points, or rather 38 points, at 6,748. Trading's heavy. The Nasdaq is up more than 11 points at 1,342. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Afghanistan is living under perhaps the most extreme Islamic rule in the world, instituted by a religious movement known as the Taliban. Taliban decrees cover the gamut of everyday life, from prayer to kite flying. Prayer is required. Kite flying and music are banned. Public executions have returned. As we'll hear, the harshest code is applied to women. In the past couple of years, Taliban forces have taken over 20 of the nation's 32 provinces. The Taliban began as a group of Islamic students who were fueled by a mix of religion and nationalism. They were joined by guerrillas who had fought the Soviet rule at the end of the Cold War. The Taliban took power in the wake of the civil war that further destroyed the country after the war with the Soviets. Earlier today, we called John Burns, who has been covering the story for the New York Times. He's the South Asia bureau chief and is in New Delhi today. I asked him to describe the code the Taliban have imposed on women.
Well, most importantly, they can't work. And as for girls, they can't go to school. They are required, as in the case of women, when leaving their homes, to be shrouded from head to foot in a garment that is called in Afghanistan a burqa. It's sort of like a tent that covers a woman from head to foot and has a kind of grill, a lace grill over the eyes for vision. There's a general discouragement for women for going out at all, and there is an absolute prohibition on their having relations, and I don't mean intimate relations, I mean even conversations, with men outside their own families. So it's a pretty restrictive regime.
How does this compare to what the code for women was before the Taliban took over?
That's a good question. I think the first thing you have to say is that these restrictions have much greater impact in the cities of Afghanistan than they do in the villages, where restrictions of this kind, although never formalized, broadly speaking, reflect the kind of lifestyle that women had. I have to say that with caution because, as we talk, I think you probably already know that women in Afghanistan, and not only in the towns and cities, have reacted quite strongly in some ways against these restrictions. But I think it's fair to say that women were pretty restricted in village life of Afghanistan before. And as for the cities, since the collapse of the communist regime in 1992, the government that was ousted from Kabul, the capital, by the Taliban in September, had imposed some sorts of restrictions, not the restriction on work, but certainly they had required women to be covered, to have their heads covered. There had been an Islamic code laid down for women. But what was significant about that, and it reflected a broader difference between the former government and the present government, was that it was largely unenforced, and as the months and then years went by, it largely fell away. So at least in the cities and towns of Afghanistan, there was a radical change when the Taliban took over.
What are the penalties for women who violate the code?
Well, one of the problems is that there's very little in all of this that is formalized. The most threatening penalty for women is being beaten. And one instance of this was an announcement, and I have to say it was a boastful announcement, that was made over the radio, Sharia, as they call it. The word Sharia means an Islamic code of justice. The radio in Kabul, which has been renamed Radio Sharia since the Taliban took over, announced somewhat proudly in late November or early December of 1996 that in a single day they had exceeded their own previous best record and had beaten 250 women in the streets of Kabul in a single day. Now, the beating takes place in many forms. It can be an antenna snapped off a car or a truck, a radio antenna. It can be, more harmfully, an electric cable doubled over and bound at one end and used as a kind of a whip. It can be quite hurtful, and you can imagine that this alone has caused many women to stay off the streets altogether.
Who does the beating?
Taliban fighters, mostly young men, mostly village boys, mostly illiterate, most of them who profess to be in service of the Quran, the Muslim holy book, have never even read it, couldn't read it indeed. Many of them attended, if they attended schools at all, they attended religious schools in the villages called madrasas, which were by and large schools for the poorest of the poor, where the curriculum never amounted to much more than rote learning of the Quran. These young men were recruited into the fighting ranks of the Taliban, so they are armed in almost every case, filled with this highly conservative version of the teachings of Islam, and then sent out onto the streets of the towns and cities that they conquered with, in effect, absolute powers.
So if a young Taliban sees a woman without a head covering on, is he empowered to just beat her?
No, he isn't. And I have to say that December, the supreme leader of the Taliban, who goes by the name of Mullah Muhammad Omar, O-M-A-R, who is a 38-year-old, really a village man, a former guerrilla fighter against the Russians, who founded the Taliban about a little over 2.5 years ago. Mullah Muhammad Omar, from his headquarters in the southern city of Kandahar, issued a decree, as he is in the habit of doing, over his title of Amir ul-Mu'mineen, meaning the Prince of All Believers. He issued a decree admonishing Taliban fighters not to beat women. But the striking thing to me about this decree was that there was a codicil, not to beat them unless they have permission from him or from other Taliban authorities. It was clear that this decree, despite the authority with which it was issued, was having little effect because it was after this that the announcement by Radio Sharia in Kabul of their achievement in beating 250 women in a single day was made. And when Western aid organizations in Kabul approached the Islamic leaders in the city to protest that these beatings of women were in defiance of the decree issued by Mullah Muhammad Omar, they were told in the most abrupt terms to mind their own business.
You estimate that there are 30,000 war widows in Afghanistan. Since they're under so many restrictions, how can they support themselves?
That is, of course, an absolutely crucial question, and it's a point that has been made again and again by the United Nations and other aid organizations in Kabul and in Kandahar to the Taliban leaders, and there has as yet been no adequate, indeed no response really of any kind, except a vague promise that these restrictions will be reviewed when, as they say, the security situation improves. It's hard to see exactly what the relationship is between security, by which they mean the war, and absence of peace, and these restrictions on women are, since, of course, falling bombs and rockets impact on men as much as they do on women. But to answer your question directly, I think I can best cite a very brave document that was authored in October by a woman by the name of Siddiqa Siddiq, who is an architect in Kabul, from an old aristocratic family in Kabul, who has managed somehow or other to continue working and working effectively through many of the succeeding regimes. Now, Siddiqa Siddiq has thus become a voice for women in Afghanistan. And with great bravery in October, she drew up a pronouncement of her own, which she handed to the Taliban and simultaneously handed to myself and to a reporter from The Guardian newspaper in England. in which she said that if you do not relent on these restrictions on women working, she said to the Taliban, then you will leave many of these women, who are among other things, the poorest of the poor for them in the main, with no alternative but to turn to prostitution to support themselves. And she said, if you do that, then you will condemn yourself to everlasting damnation in the eyes of the Prophet Muhammad. I thought this document was one of the bravest things I've ever seen, because it came at a time when these beatings of women in the street were taking place. It comes in face of the established record of the Taliban of engaging in summary public executions. She felt, and so far, thank goodness, she's been proven correct, that her own record of being of good service to the people of Afghanistan would sustain her in the face of this. But I have to tell you that when she handed me this document in a candle-lit, unheated front room of her home in the center of Kabul in late October, she was clearly a frightened woman, which of course only accentuated her bravery in doing it.
John Burns is joining us by phone from New Delhi. He's the New York Times South Asia bureau chief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Burns, and we're talking about his coverage of Afghanistan for the New York Times. He's the Times' South Asia correspondent. What new restrictions are there now on men's lives in Afghanistan since the Taliban took over?
Well, they are, of course, subject to the obvious commandment that they observe their religion. That's to say that they go five times a day to the mosques. That would be the principal daily change in their lives. Afghanistan has always been a profoundly Muslim country, but just as Italy is a profoundly Catholic country, many Muslims in Afghanistan had long since become a little bit lackadaisical about attending the mosques. Now, men have to attend the mosques, and those who do not attend the mosques are subject to being hauled out of their homes, beaten at the least, or arrested. Indeed, even if they're on the way to the mosques, if they linger, they will be beaten as the women are beaten, with electric cables. And it's quite interesting to note that these beatings often take place in the presence of Westerners, including Western reporters, which reveals another, I think, a telling truth about the Taliban, which is, so convinced are they of the rectitude of what they're doing that they don't feel apologetic about it. I have personally been allowed to attend public executions. I've seen the beatings of people going into the mosques. And so the Taliban come from a world where these things are completely normal. And it's often the case that when you ask Taliban leaders, the mullahs, the Muslim clerics who are the leaders of the Taliban, why are you doing these things? Their immediate response is, why not? As if what they're doing is the most natural thing in the world. And this is, I think, a clue to just how difficult it may be to persuade the Taliban to ameliorate some of these decrees that they've imposed on the people of Afghanistan. So that's one thing, that the men are required to go to the mosques. But there is a general climate of ideological rigidity, which reminds me very much of the Cultural Revolution in China. To some extent of the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, that you have to be very careful what you say. There are ears everywhere. The Taliban have organized quite effectively in the main cities a kind of espionage network. And, of course, there's a social code which underlies all of this, the principal element of which, of course, governs relationships with women. This is not in the main terribly difficult for most men in Afghanistan to observe, because it was a very conservative country in the first place. But for any man or woman who has a relationship outside of marriage with a member of the opposite sex, they are risking summary execution. And the proof of that is the stonings to death that have taken place in many of the cities in Afghanistan which the Taliban control.
You reported on one of those stonings, a public execution. You were there for it?
No, as a matter of fact, I was there shortly after it occurred. But what I did was, when I heard about it, I thought for once, instead of reporting on the bare outlines of this, it would be very interesting to discover the exact circumstances under which this occurred. It was a case of adultery, as the Taliban alleged it. And the deeper I got into it, the more poignant, the more affecting it was. A real terrible, terrible tragedy for the family concerned, for the two families concerned in Kandahar. And the sort of circumstance which I suspect could be replicated in almost any city in the world. In this particular case, it involved a young woman who had some years ago, 15 or 20 years ago, married a much older man. She was his second or third wife. And he had then died, leaving her with two small children and living in a home in which also were his sons by a previous marriage, if you follow me. So she became friendly with and then subsequently struck up an intimate relationship with one of the sons of her husband, sons by an earlier marriage, a man who was her own age, who was already married at the time that this relationship became intimate. And in the fullness of time, after the Taliban took over in Kandahar, of course, this relationship, which had been entirely discreet, became a matter of life and death. And this couple continued the relationship and were eventually betrayed to the Taliban by the children, the teenage sons, as a matter of fact, of the man's wife. Now, this is a complicated story, so it's difficult, I'm sure, for your listeners to follow it. But in any event, the denouement of this, which I think tells us a great deal about the modus operandi of the Taliban, was that once the Taliban's religious police, who go by the telling title of the Department for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prohibition of Vice, an organization which has its counterparts in Saudi Arabia and the Sudan and in other countries where there is a conservative Islamic government. When the Taliban religious police were apprised of this relationship, they hid themselves, five of them, at night on the flat roof of a home in southern Kandahar adjacent to the home of this family. And when the couple came to the roof, sprang across from one roof to the other and caught them, according to the Taliban's account, in flagrante delicto, in the course of sexual act, they were hauled off before an Islamic court and condemned to be stoned to death, which in time they were.
And not only were they stoned to death, the woman was lowered into a pit dug into the earth until only her chest and head were above the ground.
That's correct. The stoning actually took place on the bare earth forecourt of an ancient mosque on the northern side of Kandahar. On a boiling hot day in August, and the entire town of Kandahar was invited to attend. So there was a large crowd, many of whom I think were compelled one way and another to attend and trucked to the scene. But most appallingly, from a Western viewpoint, those in attendance included the children, including the quite young children of both of the parties who were stoned to death, both the man and the woman. The woman was lowered into a pit up to her chest. The man was bound hand and foot and stood some 10 or 12 paces away from her. A pile of rocks was piled on the ground, heavy rocks. I saw them myself. They were enough to fill the palm of a hand. And then Taliban fighters were, after a brief address by a Muslim cleric, condemning these two Taliban fighters, threw the first stones and invited people from the crowd to join in. Tellingly, apparently, many in the crowd did not wish to, and the Taliban fighters had to go into the crowd to recruit people. The man apparently died very quickly. The woman did not die quickly, and her son was called forward by the Taliban to check on whether his mother was alive or not, and he, sobbing, telling them that she was not, they then sent one of their people forward with a big rock and dropped it on her in sort of a coup de grace. It's a quite horrifying story. You can imagine the chilling effect that this has had right across Afghanistan on people. And it's not only, of course, that adultery that is banned. Even conversations with women who are not members of your immediate family are banned. Now, as far as we know, they're not executing people for that, but they certainly will be arresting and punishing them. Indeed, you can be arrested and put into a shipping container, which has become the sort of prison of choice in Afghanistan, for days or weeks at a time as a man for trimming your beard, which is another of the Taliban's social restrictions or decrees, is that men are no longer allowed to shave or to trim their beards. Again, a Taliban or a conservative Islamic interpretation of the Quran, which, according to Muslim scholars that I've spoken to, is nowhere to be found in the Quran. It's more an interpretation of the Quran that was made in the centuries that followed the death of the Prophet Muhammad.
Well, what kind of reaction have you found to the public executions?
Well, among Taliban fighters, enthusiasm. I subsequently attended a public execution in Kabul by Kalashnikov rifle of a murderer who was shot to death by the surviving father and husband of a family of four who were murdered in the course of a robbery. The crowd was mostly Taliban fighters, and the blood was up that day. There was sort of cheer that went up at the first staccato burst of rifle fire, and then when the executioner stepped forward to the body and fired directly into his chest from a distance of about 2 or 3 feet, there was a second cheer. But the reaction in the population at large is, I would say, on the whole, not approving. It's my experience traveling around the world, no great insight this, that people in the main, wherever you go, aspire to the same things and react in the same way to the same sorts of things. And if Americans are shocked by that sort of thing, the reaction is not entirely different in Afghanistan. People do not like brutality. They do not like the unnecessary shedding of blood, or even the shedding of blood, which considered necessary from a social point of view, that takes on a kind of brutal edge to it. So I would say that the general reaction amongst the people of Afghanistan was that we have been a civilized people, and this is not civilized behavior.
John Burns is the New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief. We'll talk more about Afghanistan in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Taliban, who they are, and how they came to power in Afghanistan. We continue our conversation with the New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief, John Burns. He'll also tell us about the difficulties of getting information in Afghanistan, where women are no longer allowed to talk with men in public. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief John Burns. We're talking about his reports from Afghanistan, where an Islamic fundamentalist movement known as the Taliban has taken power. Who are the Taliban?
Yes, who are the Taliban? The Taliban had never been heard of until the late summer of 1994. But first of all, what does the name mean? Talib, it's an Arab word, means a religious student. Literally, I believe it means a seeker after truth. And the Taliban were, in part, drawn from religious students who attended these village religious schools called madrasas, some of them in Afghanistan and some of them in Pakistan. Why in Pakistan? Because the Afghan war, as your listeners will know, drove millions, in fact, 3.5 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan as refugees, most of whom went to Pakistan. So there were madrasas, religious schools in Pakistan, that were attended by Afghans, very conservative religious schools. There were also, of course, such madrasas in virtually every village of Afghanistan. So the Taliban, which is the plural of the word Talib, originally came from these religious schools. But as the movement grew in the late summer of 1994, they were quickly joined by people who were not religious students, people who were members of other armed groups that had fought against the Soviet forces that occupied Afghanistan in the 1980s. Those armed groups were known as Mujahideen, or Holy Warriors. They had set to a civil war amongst themselves when the Russians withdrew in 1989. And the Taliban, to briefly summarize their rise from nowhere, their rise was provoked by this civil war, which had become extremely brutal. Basically, Afghanistan became a vast collection of warlordships, of extremely brutal, savage warlordships, of former Mujahideen groups who had fought the Russians and then turned to rape and pillage all across Afghanistan. And I think American listeners would want to know that these people had been supported, financed, and armed during the 1980s by the United States principally, also by other Western powers and by Saudi Arabia. But there's an inescapable, I believe, moral responsibility in all of this for the West, in that billions of dollars of Western aid, including at least $5 billion of American taxpayers' money, went into Afghanistan in the 1980s and found their way to these so-called Mujahideen groups who were fighting the Russians. This was, of course, the last great confrontation of the Cold War. These Mujahideen groups, even before the Russians went, had begun to behave in the main in a highly disreputable fashion. They became growers and exporters of opium and heroin. Afghanistan is now the largest single country source of heroin reaching the West. They imposed a terror on the areas they occupied. They engaged in rape and pillage and abduction of young girls. Now, this was the situation that prevailed across Afghanistan at the time that the Taliban began their rise.
In fact, you tell a story in one of your articles about Mullah Omar, who's now the head of the Taliban, a story that you say has entered into Afghanistan's folklore. And this story, I think, helps describe how the Taliban became popular enough to take over as much of the country as they have. Would you tell the story?
Yes, indeed, and I think it's crucial to both an understanding, a fair understanding of the situation in Afghanistan now. Sometime in the late spring of 1994, in a village outside of Kandahar, which happens to be the home village of Mullah Muhammad Omar, who is now the supreme ruler of the parts of Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban, in this village, two young girls were abducted by a Mujahideen group, bandits, really. They had their heads shaven, and they were taken, these young girls, to a checkpoint, a bunker, occupied on the outskirts of the village by these bandits, where they were then gang-raped over a period of some time. The villagers, outraged, came to Mullah Muhammad Omar, who was in retirement, if you will, and is the age of 34 or 5 at the time, from an adult lifetime spent fighting the Russians. He had left the ranks of the Mujahideen in disgust at the way they behaved, returned to his village and become a student, a religious student, at the village religious school called a madrasa. The villagers came to him and said, "You must do something. You were a brave fighter against the Russians. You must do something." He gathered around him a group of 16... let me see if I can remember this. He gathered around him a group of about 30 other men who could muster between them about 16 Kalashnikov rifles. And these men went, stormed the checkpoint, freed the girls, took the commander of the checkpoint, tied a noose around his neck, tied the other end of the noose to the barrel of a Soviet tank, and hanged him publicly, left the body hanging. This, by the way, was something that the Taliban continued to do and still do all across Afghanistan. It's the most, signal means of execution. Mullah Muhammad Ammar, by his own account, would have left it at that, except that word of this incident spread quickly around the region. And very quickly, other villagers started coming to these men and saying, "Can you do the same for us? Can you liberate us from these bandits?" And so pretty quickly, the Taliban began to liberate village by village, to gather arms and gather supporters. Many of these Mujahideen groups simply ran up the white flag and joined the Taliban. And pretty quickly, from nowhere, within a matter of no more than six months, the Taliban had not only taken control of the city of Kandahar, which is the second most important city in Afghanistan after the capital, Kabul, but had taken control of first a half a dozen, then a dozen, then 15, and now 20 provinces. So it's fair to say that despite the tyranny that the Taliban have imposed, it's a tyranny that succeeds a terror, a preceding terror. And many Afghans will say, much as they loathe the new tyranny, they will say that they prefer it to the old terror.
So let me see if I understand. During the Cold War, in the last days of Soviet control of Afghanistan, the Mujahideens tried to drive out the Soviet communists. When the communists were driven out, the Mujahideen factionalized, they fought against each other, and they inflicted terror on the general population. The Taliban drove back the Mujahideen and stopped the terror that the Mujahideen were inflicting on the people, but now the Taliban have the people living in terror.
It's true, it's true. The difference, I think it's fair to say, that at least in profession, the Taliban are different in that theirs is, whilst it's an arbitrary tyranny, it conforms to certain rules, or the Taliban will tell you it conforms to certain rules. These are the rules of the Quran as the Taliban interpret it. In principle at least, the days when anybody with a gun could walk into anybody's home in Afghanistan and rape a woman or rob the house and murder the husband, those days, and abduct the children, abduct the daughters, those days are gone. I say in principle because this isn't, the Taliban are an arbitrary power, and the enforcement of their new rules is in the hands of a large and motley group of young men with weapons, many of whom are not in origin or by character very different from the Mujahideen who preceded them. And it's pretty clear that the Taliban, as of now at least, do not have effective control of their own people. So there are still incidents in Herat in the northwest, in my experience, in Kandahar, in Kabul, in Jalalabad. I'm talking about the four principal cities of Afghanistan and goodness knows where else in the villages of Afghanistan. There are still incidents of pillage and rape by Taliban fighters. But I think there still remains a difference. First of all, it's on a very much smaller scale than before. And second of all, if a Taliban fighter is caught engaging this kind of activity, he is summarily executed. So yes, there is a difference. And as I say, I think most Afghans, at least now, with the memories of the Mujahideen tyranny so recent, would say that much as they dislike the new order, it's at least not as bad as the old order. But I have to say that there are already signs, and this is within 3 or 4 months, of the Taliban taking control of Kandahar. And it's much more advanced, 3 or 4 months of the Taliban taking control of Kabul, the capital. And it's much more advanced in Herat and Kandahar, which they conquered at a much earlier stage. There are already signs that people are beginning to measure the Taliban not by the standard of what immediately preceded them, namely the terror of the Mujahideen, but the more distant standard of the old Afghan society before the Soviets arrived, the Afghan society of the 1970s, which of course is well enough remembered by many people who are now only in their 30s and 40s, which they remember as a more civil, a gentle and kinder time, and indeed a time which they will tell you is much truer to the tradition of Afghanistan, which they will tell you is not a tradition of brutality and of extremism. So the Taliban have a problem that the ground, in a sense, is shifting under them, that the people who would have hailed them as liberators only a few months or in the most 2 years ago are now beginning to remember the time under the king, the now exiled king, when they lived a gentler and altogether more civilized life.
What is the United States' position on the Taliban?
Broadly speaking, there are those who would favor the United States engaging, as they say, with the Taliban, perhaps even recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan, which no government in the world has currently done. These people argue that the Taliban, in the first place, can end the war in Afghanistan, which is a major good in itself. Second, and that they're the only people who could do so. Secondly, they say the Taliban have promised, and I have to say that these promises have proven utterly empty so far, have promised to put an end to the drug trafficking from Afghanistan, which, as I think I already mentioned, has made Afghanistan the largest single country source of opium and heroin reaching the Western world. And they have also promised to put an end to the use of Afghanistan as a base for international terrorism, a promise which, of course, has a large resonance in the United States, where, for example, to cite only one instance, the bombing of the World Trade Center could be traced directly back to terrorists who got their training and their start in Afghanistan, or at least under the umbrella of the American CIA-supported resistance to the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. So those are the reasons that are cited by American diplomats for engaging with the Taliban. The other view is, of course, that the United States should have absolutely nothing to do with an organization which, in the first place, has proven to be so repressive towards women and is in the process of imposing its own tyranny on Afghanistan. Now, a reason that's not often cited, but I believe has a compelling force in Washington, at least within certain parts of the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department, is Iran. As you know, Iran, there is a large concern with Iran in Washington. And the Taliban, curiously, although they are an Islamic fundamentalist group, are the sworn enemies of Iran. I won't take too much of your time to explain why that is, but it has to do with the divide within Islam between the Sunni and Shia. The Taliban are Sunni Muslims, that's to say the group that comprise the majority of Muslims in the world. The government of Iran and the majority of people in Iran are Shia Muslims. Because of this divide, there is a deep enmity between the Taliban and Iran. Some American diplomats see in that enmity an opportunity to further the containment of Iran if the United States were to engage with the Taliban.
John Burns is my guest, and he's South Asia correspondent for the New York Times. We're talking about his coverage of Afghanistan. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your own experiences covering Afghanistan, but first let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Burns, South Asia correspondent for the New York Times, and we're talking about his coverage of Afghanistan, which is now predominantly taken over by the Taliban rebels, a group of Islamic extremists who have imposed a very harsh religious and social code on the people of Afghanistan. Part of the new code that the Taliban have imposed is that women are not allowed to talk to men in public. You are a man. And it is your job to get as much information as you can from men and women. How are you able to talk to women? Are you supposed to, as a foreigner, be subject to the code?
Absolutely, and you have to be very careful about this. More than once, I have been threatened by Taliban, young Taliban men with Kalashnikov rifles, once actually struck with the butt of a Kalashnikov rifle for precisely this reason, speaking to an Afghan woman. That's something that in the main I would not do any longer in any public place. And an Afghan woman would very likely not even begin a conversation with a foreigner in a public place. She would more likely move rapidly away. So if one wants to do that these days, one has to make arrangements which are clandestine in nature, which remind me very much of the kind of things that, as a reporter, I used to have to do in China during the Cultural Revolution and during the Soviet Union during the worst times of the Cold War, which is to say to go at night or before dawn, to make sure that you're not spotted by anybody, to give assurances of confidentiality and so forth. So there are some risks involved for Western reporters who do this, which are manageable because I think we can assume that we're not going to be summarily executed. The risks, of course, are much, much greater for the Afghan women who agree to do this.
What other aspects of the social code are you subjected to? What else do you have to be careful of while you're reporting on Afghanistan?
That's the principal one, but I have to say that this, too, is changing. You must remember the Taliban came into Kabul with probably not more than 1,000 fighters, and they have nothing of a government that you would understand as a government. The government is largely non-functioning. They haven't paid the civil servants in Kabul since they arrived. So to know exactly what the rules are and aren't is difficult to tell, but there's definitely a tightening vice around not just Western reporters, but Western aid organizations. The Taliban is a totalitarian organization. It's an organization of a kind that we've seen many times before in this century, and I would say the kind of organization which has been responsible for a great deal of the misery in this century. They have a millennial universalist philosophy, which brooks of no opposition whatsoever. There are no laws either to constrain what the Taliban do. It was logical to assume, and I told my colleagues in Kabul at the time, that the freest time that we would have in reporting on the activities of the Taliban would be in the early weeks after they took Kabul, that soon enough they would come to understand that what we do is in many respects inimical to what they wish to achieve. And as that realization sinks in, so they will then further restrict the activities of reporters. This has already begun. Visas have become more difficult to obtain. Reporters are not allowed any longer to stay at places of their choice in the cities and towns of Afghanistan. Specifically in Kabul, we are required to report to and stay in only one hotel. And we are required, in essence, to accept as, for example, you have to in Baghdad, a sort of minder, a government official who is assigned to you as an interpreter in principle, whose real function, of course, is to watch what you do and, more important, to watch what Afghans do in interacting with you. So it's getting more and more difficult to operate as a reporter in Taliban areas of Afghanistan.
One of the things that's made it possible for the Taliban to take over Afghanistan is that after the war between Afghanistan rebels and the communists, the country was just torn apart. It was physically decimated. The social fabric was torn apart. Can you still see the destruction caused by that war with the Soviets and the civil war that followed?
Oh, absolutely. The word destroyed is used very often, devastated, in our business. But I have to say, and I've been reporting around the world for a very long time in some very nasty places, that Afghanistan is easily the most devastated, destroyed, obliterated country I have ever seen. Much of what constituted a civil society has been literally reduced to rubble in Afghanistan. Large parts of the cities, 60% in the case of Kabul, probably 50% of Kandahar, are just rubble, nothing more than that. Most of the schools are gone, and those that aren't are closed anyway. The hospitals barely function. It is the most terrible thing to see. What was brought about by, in the main, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and I have to say, by the Western response to that, this vast amount of weapons that were poured into the hands of totally irresponsible people over a period of now nearly 20 years, that have affected this tremendous destruction. I think it's not too much to compare the destruction of Afghanistan in our time with the kind of destruction that was wrought by the hordes of Genghis Khan centuries ago.
Since there is so much that is outlawed now, what do people do during the day in Kabul? Kabul is the most urban area, and I imagine in some ways the most modern era area of Afghanistan. So how do people spend their time?
That's a good question. Virtually all public entertainments have gone. The cinemas have been closed. Music halls have been closed. You're not allowed to play music. Soccer and other sports have been banned. Even the flying of kites by children has been banned, although I'm delighted to say that most children don't know that, or if they do, they ignore it. When you ask the mullahs of Afghanistan what are people supposed to do for entertainment, they will tell you that they should either read the Quran, or, in a more enlightened view expressed to me by one of the top mullahs of the Taliban, he said they should go to the parks and observe the flowers and the things that grow there, because all the truths of Islam are to be found in nature. I found that quite appealing, except, of course, that it takes place against the background of this tyranny, where everything that you and I would know as public, as entertainment, has been shut down. So the answer is, in any event, I think, to be fair, in a society so reduced, so utterly devastated, there wasn't a great deal of entertainment to be had before. Most people are so busy just surviving that the thought of going to a cinema was in any event remote, even if they could afford it. But the fact is there are now no longer any cinemas. There's only one radio station, and all it offers you is either Taliban news or the verses of the Quran. It's an extremely rigid, ideological, totalitarian society. And I think the closest counterpart that I could think of outside of the Islamic world, and I doubt if there is anything quite like it anywhere in the Islamic world, would probably be North Korea.
My guest is John Burns, the New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief. We'll talk more about Afghanistan after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Burns of the New York Times, we're talking about his coverage of the Taliban Islamic movement, which has taken over most of Afghanistan. Have you been in a situation where the Taliban logic that is being used on you has struck you as absurd, but your logic was totally dismissed as completely unacceptable?
Oh, yes. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You get into very curious situations. If I think quickly of the sort of thing that occurs, I have a beard and slightly unkempt hair, and I found myself at a checkpoint in the middle of the night once, where I was marched off for prayers by, at the point of a rifle, by a Taliban at a checkpoint, who was not the slightest bit interested in my protestations in every language that I could summon. That I was not a Muslim. And my fear was not, I don't mind going through Muslim observances, I simply don't know them well enough to be able to do them effectively. And it seemed clear to me that this man must have known by the circumstances, since I'd arrived in a vehicle with other foreigners. It seemed clear to me that he must know that I was a foreigner and that I was overwhelmingly likely not to be a Muslim. But still, none of this was availing. So, yes, their world and our world are very, very far apart. And there is often a deep lack of comprehension that fills that void, just as there was, for example, during, as I've mentioned before, dealing with Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution in China.
So what happened in that circumstance? Did you go through the Muslim prayers?
I did, and I didn't do it very well, and this chap lost interest in me very quickly because he had somebody else to turn his attentions to. But I thought it was dangerous because The risk was that he might think that I was trying to make a mockery of the process of prayers, which of course I wouldn't do, but simply not knowing. I've seen it 1,000 times or perhaps 10,000 times, but it's one thing to watch Muslims at prayer. It's another thing to know the rhythm and sequence of the observances, which I simply don't.
I take it, since women aren't allowed to talk to men in public in Afghanistan, that there aren't any women reporters either from Afghanistan or from other countries there right now?
Well, there are, and I must say I admire them, because, of course, it's difficult, much more difficult for them to operate in Afghanistan than it is for me. And there have been ugly incidents. One I'll tell you about briefly, in October in Kabul, when some women reporters, one of them from the Associated Press and another one from, I believe, one of the English papers, were interviewing a Taliban commander at a military base in the north end of Kabul when a mullah entered the room. As many of these mullahs are, and it needs to be said, I think, a man who's handicapped by his own fighting in the war against the Russians. This particular man had one eye and one leg. He came in, saw the women talking to, women reporters talking to this commander, a Taliban commander, and went berserk and took his stick to beat not the women who were fled, as you may imagine, as quickly as they could, not the women reporters, but to beat the commander with his crutch, all the while shouting at this chap for talking to infidels and particularly for talking to women. So that's the kind of climate in which women reporters in Afghanistan have to operate, but they go nonetheless. And of course, I must say that the Taliban are not all quite as primitive as the mullah with the stick. There are some quite sophisticated people in the Taliban leadership, some of whom have even attended Western universities, some of them in the foreign ministry and some in other ministries. And these people, of course, know much better than that, and they, at their press conferences, accept and answer questions from women reporters. But there have been just as many occasions where press conferences have begun with the Taliban mullahs announcing that they either the women reporters would have to leave the room or that they would not be allowed to ask questions. And it has raised an interesting moral dilemma for those of us reporters from the West who are not women as to whether or not we should proceed with news conferences when these kinds of edicts have been laid down. So far, in every case that I know of, we have done, but it's a subject which I have raised and discussed with my colleagues as to whether, in fact, there isn't a responsibility for us in a circumstance like that to say, one for all and all for one, if you wish to speak to us, you'll speak to all of us. It's a very difficult dilemma which remains unresolved, but I think it's worthy of discussion.
John Burns, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
John Burns is the New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief. He spoke to us from New Delhi. He plans to return to Afghanistan in a few weeks. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tenenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.